So Tim invited me to speak on addiction to follow his fine talk last week. So it'll be the idea is it'll be a little shorter, and then we'll have time for a breakout group and also for discussion. And I'm mindful that this is a subtle area, and there's pain related for some people. So I'm kind of got, I thought about that a lot. I'm conscious of that if I accidentally touch on sensitive territory, apologize. But it's such a important area in our practice, and really has a whole lot to do with what the path's about at all. I mean, unless we're Buddhists, unless we're fully realized Buddhists, we all live with aspects of addiction in our hearts and minds. And working with addiction and unbinding ourselves from it is, in a sense, what the Four Noble Truths and the spiritual path are all about. And in particular, the first two of the Four Noble Truths, suffering and the cause of suffering, are a neatly put description of what addiction is and how it impacts us. And the second two truths, the possibility of freedom from suffering and how to get there, the Eightfold Path, in a sense, are how to free ourselves from addiction. So in our society, in terms of this word addiction, there's a sort of a judgmental bias about someone who's considered to be an addict, which in most people's minds means maybe addiction to drugs or alcohol, something like that. And often there's some, sense, oh, those people have a character flaw. That's the wonderful work that 12-step work has done to understand it's not that, but that's still sort of is in our society in ways. But it's kind of humbling and compassion generating to realize that all of us who are not yet Buddhists, certainly myself, are ultimately we share the same qualities with any addicted person. I mean, in our own ways, we're caught and conditioned by grasping ways we relate to phenomena, internal and external. So all of us have some of those qualities in us. And last week, Tim offered a three-part analysis of addiction that was really cool and resonated in some very useful ways. He said addiction contains three components. It often manifests in repetitive behavior that grasps us, and that behavior is often tied to some immediate pleasure. And then that pleasure-seeking behavior often has drawbacks or consequences in our lives. And look at how this parallels the first two noble truths, suffering and the cause of suffering. Looking at this through the window of this word addiction, this question of addiction, it clarifies that these first two noble truths, they aren't some like gloomy overview in terms of suffering. It's not this gloomy overview, but actually a skillful assessment of how we bring suffering upon ourselves, how we bring suffering upon ourselves with a related suggestion that we can be free. And at the crux of this is a second noble truth, the cause of suffering. Now, in his very first sermon the Buddha gave, very first sermon after his enlightenment, was to his friends, the five ascetics, under the trees of Deer Park, Sarnath, now called Sarnath, it's about 15 kilometers north of Varanasi, the ancient holy city of India. And right from the start, the very first sermon, he talked about the cause of suffering. In a sense, he touched on this question of addiction. He said, the Buddha said, "Now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. It is this craving which leads to rebecoming, accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there, that is, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for becoming, craving for disbecoming." But remember that one of the great breakthroughs of the Buddha, because he was 2,600 years ago, this was a time when asceticism was venerated traditionally in India by wandering practitioners. And he himself, as many of you know, had starved himself to the edge of death, the Buddha had, in his quest for enlightenment. So one of the huge breakthroughs was that joy and happiness are fine. Joy and happiness are good in the path. In fact, the path is about finding joy and happiness. So this kind of clarifies that the suffering he was talking about there, it's about the craving. It's not about the pleasure. It's about the craving. That's the issue. He says that about three times. So he says, just to repeat, he says, it is this craving which leads to re-becoming, accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there, craving for sensual pleasures. That's the problem. And that's what addiction's about. That's what addiction's about. And whatever, you know, level it operates in us. I mean, you know, an apple tastes good. Touch on the skin feels nice. All these things are fine when they come to us, when they happen. They're fine as long as we don't grasp after them. That's the problem. Now, I learned a funny lesson. I can tell a little story. In the fall of 1991, I was on a solo 3-month retreat in India, north of McLeod Ganj, up in the kind of the foothills in a little hut. And me and this other Westerner, we had the great honor to buy a chocolate cake. And we bought this chocolate cake for the 5th birthday of Ling Rinpoche, the reincarnation of the junior tutor of the Dalai Lama. So he was 4 years old and he was just turning 5. He was an extraordinary being then. I will say as an aside that we had a little gathering of Westerners and we were asked, there was about 20 of us, you know, all these world traveler types. And Ling Rinpoche sitting there in his robes on a throne, 4 years old. He did have a few toys, but man, he was present. And we're asking him questions like, well, do you remember your former lifetimes? Well, he didn't. And then this woman says, do you want to ask us any questions? Well, he did. All of a sudden, he leans forward and he says, how many people practice the Dharma in your countries? How deeply do they practice the Dharma? We're all going, whoa, because 4 years old. And he says, the Dharma is not a plaything. The Dharma is about changing your minds. So my mind was blown. And any doubts I have about recognized reincarnations kind of went away. So we bought him this cake, this chocolate cake for his 5th birthday, Ling Rinpoche. And there was this learning for me in this birthday moment, because I don't think he'd ever seen a chocolate cake before, a Western chocolate cake. And he just lit up. He had this beautiful, simple joy and happiness of the cake. He was beaming and laughing. And at the same time, it was so clear that he wasn't going to like run out and try to get another cake. It had this beautiful openness to it. It's kind of like the Dalai Lama, you know, something happy happens. He's happy, but he's not trying to get it to happen again. So I just really took that in my heart, this beautiful happiness and joy about this cake, which was not about being attached to the cake. It just, cake happens. Beautiful. Then done. And it was like not a whiff of grasping or addiction, seemed to me. A real model for how to enjoy. So as the Buddha clarifies, the problem isn't whether we enjoy something or not. Issue is whether we yearn or lust after that object of enjoyment, hoping to recreate some moment we experienced, or maybe relief from suffering by doing that again and again. That's where it gets difficult, right? And suddenly, on many, whatever level it is, that yearning has pulled us into a cycle of reaching out and grasping for our well-being, as opposed to finding it within. And one of the challenging questions with addictions, especially more gripping ones, is how far the habits or inclinations we see may be from the causes of them. And we can find ourselves caught in addictive tendencies, or people around us may be, and we don't know where that, what's the underlying suffering causing that. You know what I mean? It's, and being able to see that helps open it up. He's only two stories. We've got one more story. But my father, he served in the Pacific Theater during World War II. He was a leader of a howitzer battery, and he was in four landings. I don't know how he survived. I don't know how I'm here, because he was in four landings, the Aleutians, Kwantlen, Leyte Gulf, and Okinawa. And he returned with a Bronze Heart for bravery, a Purple Heart, for bravery, a Purple Heart, because he had no left leg, which was taken by a grenade. He saw people killed. He killed people, other complications. He came back with some trauma. And he was a cheerful guy before he left. I know his, my aunt, we talk about his dad before he left. He was a real happy guy. Came back with trauma. It's life, right? And back then, no one knew about PTSD. And my dad's trauma kind of simmered down in there. And in his prime, you know, when I was growing up, he was a powerful and highly paid corporate executive in Manhattan. But he was also depending on alcohol for relief because he didn't know what to do. You know, I don't think he knew what was underneath. And back then things were so different. He once told me if he ever went to a therapist and someone found out, his career would be over. That's how things were back then. So he sort of had to suck it up, and, you know, and I could see as I grew up how he found some, you know, respite to his suffering and drinking. And I could sort of intuit that the problem wasn't about alcohol, about something else. He had suffering there, but he had no path. He had no dharma. He had no way to see through these factors and let go, and to understand that they were impermanent, that there wasn't a self to just let it go. He didn't know how. So that manifestation of addiction, it's easy to define. He's an alcoholic. But here in 2021, it gets subtler, doesn't it? You know, we got this incredible consumer technological culture system, technology distraction system that is all around us. And, you know, if we're not happy in our skins, if we're disconsolate, if we're not finding peace within ourselves, what do? And I sort of, this is like the big we, you know, human beings. And if that thing we do seems to work, gives us a little relief, then people return to it over and over with the possibility that this thing can become an obsession. Then it's a problem. Tim, and you're so sweet, he mentioned chess as one thing he identified that he is engaged with, and sometimes it gets a little obsessive for him. And, you know, even at my age, I'm embarrassed how much I know about cars, especially, you know, new models that are very fast and expensive, which is, so there's this little bit of obsessive attention goes there. And that's just like, that's like embarrassing to admit here in the time of climate change, but there you go. So whatever it is that kind of pulls us in, it's something we can really work with and look at here, because we have practice that we're working with. But subtler things, you know, than drugs and alcohol, have an addictive quality, keep us from being fully present. Could be video games, could be binge watching stuff on Amazon Prime, could be social media, could be professional sports, our careers, coding, Dungeons and Dragons, whatever. You know, whatever we channel ourselves into and kind of get not here because of it. Something to pay attention to. And how often, you know, have we been kind of down or at sorts, and then we remembered a time that we did something or ingested something and it lifted our spirits? And of course, there's a place for change of scene or a good meal. I mean, there's a place for that, obviously. But we can face forks in the road depending on where we are in the path and how compulsively we turn towards something other than this moment for relief. And for me, the sniff test, I guess, is, you know, whether or not I'm wandering into addiction territory is whether or not I'm staying mindful. Because mindfulness, you know, means just staying aware of everything, including sense objects, as they arise and pass, letting them arise and fall as they will. But the addictive quality means trying to grasp, stop the good ones, keep them, and not have the bad ones. And you can see sometimes if something's good happening, we're engaged in it, we kind of put up a little bit of a barrier, we kind of hold it in a little bit. We're not so present. I can see that myself sometimes. And so we know how fragile or how delicately balanced mindfulness can be, and our attention can be drawn from this moment into something we think will bring satisfaction or relief. And sometimes in practice, you may experience like the idea of something we could do, especially on the planning mind. You know, Hawaii, it keeps coming, and images of big white beaches keep popping up again and again, or whatever your thing is. Maybe it's ice boats, I don't know. But something that engages, it keeps popping up. And that is a clue. And right in that place is where our practice is. Because it's not so much oppressing it, it's like bringing mindfulness back again and again and seeing through it. But we can see right in those moments how this addictive quality can displace mindfulness. And because we know how to practice, it's something we can work with. So it's not, for many of us, it's not behavior that we do. You know, it's more subtle. It's thirsting or yearning we experience that is part of where our edge is. To be able to work with that and not get stuck in it, but hold it gently and compassionately, but still see it for what it is. It's a way to unwind. And this illustrates, by the way, the Buddha's brilliance in picking out so clearly our perception of things as pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. The Pali word Vedana, many of you know that, the second foundation of mindfulness. It always seemed a little obscure. Like, what's that? You know, when I was first studying the body, I got it. But what's this Vedana thing? It seems sort of odd. It's very short in the Satipatthana Sutta. But actually, from this point of view, thinking about addiction, it drives everything. Because that's what we do. Something comes up, we think, oh, pleasant. Want it. Oh, unpleasant. Back it off. You know, we just do zillions of those things unconsciously. We do them to whatever degree addiction, some addictive quality is working in us. If we're mindful, then we go, oh, pleasant, I'm seeing that. Oh, unpleasant, I'm seeing that. But it just kind of blows through. And that's the power of it. So the more I've kind of looked into this over the years, the more I've become just amazed at the brilliance of the Buddha's understanding in terms of Vedanas in particular, and how it's right in this area of craving and right in this area of addiction and attachment. And for me, using the term addiction, which is pretty raw, about our journey here, is kind of daunting, but it's also kind of energizing. I mean, it's daunting because it can be a little gnarly to apply this term addiction to ourselves, to something that might not be so obviously so. But I think there's a reality to it, and it's worth doing. And it's energizing because it pushes us. You know, it pushes us to recognize the power these cravings have over us and the impacts they may have on our lives and others in our lives. So it's energizing because we want to do something about it. We want to not stay there. So it's actually, you know, useful. And it's kind of a phenomena on the spiritual path that as we move forward, our discerning gets more subtle. You know what I mean? So it may have been like, in terms of ethics, this wide range of stuff that was just fine. And then as we kind of slowly over time get clearer and clearer about ethics, it becomes a diamond edge. You know, it's like we don't have much wiggle room anymore because it's really clear. Oh, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that because it's going to hurt someone. And the same with addiction, you know, these addictive qualities. It becomes a diamond edge. And we see how we're pulled and tugged. And we just want to not be pulled and tugged, to see through it. So it becomes actually invigorating because it means that we're growing when that's happening. It's just, but it's not easy. It's not easy. And, you know, activities of body, speech, and mind that might have once seemed innocuous when we were speaking as a stupid male when we were like in college or something, now are like, no, that's absolutely not, you know? And so we start to see through them. And looking, this question of, we start to see how these like addiction aspects condition our mind, you know, body, speech, and mind, how it conditions our mind. And that becomes really important because when you're sitting on the cushion, that's what you got, is your mind conditions, you know? And the more we clarify it in terms of our ethical actions, the deeper our practice goes, but also in terms of this whole area of addiction, you know, the more we can see clearly where we're tugged and just be mindful of it rather than yielding to it, rather than dwelling in it, rather than giving energy into it, just seeing through it, it clarifies the qualities of our mind. It's a attribute that we need to nurture in our practice. We find that anything that obscures the mind gets more and more untenable. Like, just don't want to do that. I mean, life is short. And you see, you taste the possibility of freedom. So why would we put up with any clouding in the minds? And what really brings us home, and I'm getting near the end, is seeing what really brings home the importance of clarity around addictive qualities is seeing how they impact others. Seeing how they impact others, because we're not alone in this. And this is one area where it's so significant. I mean, Tim had this lovely story about getting impatient going on trips with his family, you know, and learning not to do that. These behaviors have issues or drawbacks in our lives, he said. And they do. I mean, I have a propensity. I tend to have too many projects I'm doing because I care about stuff and life is short, the airport, whatever. It's great in a way. It's great in a way, but it can have this addictive quality to it because I'm doing it to help people. But what about my own wife who, you know, there's times when I'm in the office and working on something and she comes in and wants to be heard. And I can see that I have to struggle to let go of this paragraph I wanted to finish. You know, I mean, it's really like, I really want to finish a paragraph, but there's this actual human being here who I love, who wants to be heard. And, you know, I understand the priorities, but I can see the pull. And it is an addictive quality. Yep. Right? I mean, workaholism, careerism, just one's sense of identity and the things one accomplishes, all those things can get in the way of actually being present with the human beings around us. So as I've thought of it in those terms, especially because, well, you know, my dad was an alcoholic and wasn't very present, it's helped me understand just to let go, and pay attention. You know, if someone arrives, then arrive and let go of the thing I was going to do, whether it's working or, you know, whatever it else would be, playing a video game. That's not my particular thing. My son's a coder and that's what he does. He writes video games. So it's kind of hard to pry him away from the screen sometimes to talk to him, but whatever it is, people, you know, just being conscious with human beings. And I can just see what the Buddha was talking about, where he said, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for becoming. But the good news is we have the tools to work with this, and especially in the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path.